They play very traditional Bavarian songs, and they also mix it with music from the charts, because people like to sing to what we call schunkeln here. Dancing a little bit.
The average person in the West has a certain understanding of Islam. They can be pretty brutal towards people who are accused of being homosexual.
It depends on interpretation. I mean, for centuries, Europeans regarded the Islamic world as the place that you went to if you wanted to have gay sex.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. Northern Ireland targets bias crimes, but Indonesia may criminalize queers, pink lederhosen dress up Munich's Oktoberfest, and Islam and its homo contradictions. Those stories and more this week, now that you've discovered This Way Out.
I'm Cindy Friedman.
And I'm John Beaupre.
With NewsWrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting the lesbian and gay community for the week ending October 4th, 2003. Northern Ireland will be introducing a ministerial order allowing judges to increase penalties for crimes motivated by bias, including homophobia. In fact, the move originated as a response to gay bashing, although Northern Ireland Secretary Paul Murphy emphasized recent incidents motivated by religious prejudice in announcing his government's plan at a British Labour Party conference. Racial prejudice would also be covered. Sentencing enhancement for hate crimes is already established in the rest of the UK, but that law does not include anti-gay attacks, although the addition is under discussion in Britain and Scotland.
But Indonesia's Ministry of Justice and Human Rights is drafting major amendments to the criminal code that could lead to prison terms for consensual homosexual acts, it was announced this week. Current law in Indonesia largely reflects its former Dutch occupation and generally does not impose criminal sanctions on personal lives, but some of the country's large Muslim population have been demanding the nation adopt Islam's Sharia law. The Ministry of Justice is attempting to add elements of both Sharia and some local customs to the code, criminalizing a number of what have been considered ethical or moral issues. Reports differ on the specifics of the sex crimes. The Jakarta Post cites Article 427 as punishing any homosexual act with up to 7 years imprisonment, although foreign wire services claim that applies only when the participants are under 18. The Post also cited Article 423 as treating sodomy and oral sex as acts of rape, punishable by up to 12 years imprisonment. The ministry says its proposal is still in an early stage, although it will be submitted to the parliament soon and probably decided there after next year's elections.
But South Africans marched by the hundreds and partied by the thousands in Johannesburg at the 14th annual National Gay and Lesbian Pride Festival. Once a daring and illegal demonstration, the celebration has become a global destination with commensurate support from the region's tourism authority.
The Employment Non-Discrimination Act, ENDA, was reintroduced this week in the U.S. Senate. Some form of federal gay and lesbian civil rights protections have been introduced for about 30 years, but reached a floor vote only in 1996, when the Senate defeated ENDA by a single vote. On the same day, it overwhelmingly adopted the anti-gay so-called Defense of Marriage Act. In the last session, ENDA won approval from a Senate committee for the first time, but never reached the floor. A companion measure will be introduced shortly in the House. Despite active lobbying by the Human Rights Campaign, the current version of ENDA would not protect transgenders.
Also introduced in the U.S. Senate this week was the Domestic Partner Health Benefits Equity Act. Currently, the value of health coverage provided by employers to their unmarried workers' domestic partners is treated as the workers' taxable income, while similar coverage for legal spouses and other dependents is not. The employer also faces more federal tax liability. The new bill would equalize treatment of domestic partner and spousal health coverage for federal tax purposes for both workers and employers.
71 gay and lesbian couples documented their relationships on the opening day of Cook County, Illinois' Domestic Partners Registry. Cook County includes the city of Chicago, and it is more populous than 31 of the 50 United States, with nearly 5.5 million residents. According to the 2000 census, those residents include well over 13,000 same-gender domestic partners. Couple of 12-year standing John Pennycuff and Robert Castillo waited outside the door half the night to be the first to sign up. They proudly displayed their certificate to the media along with a sign reading, "Just Partnered." But while domestic partners go to the same desk, fill out similar paperwork, and plunk down the same $30 as couples obtaining marriage licenses, the Cook County Registry carries no tangible benefits except to provide documentation for employers and others who choose to recognize domestic partnerships.
Newly enacted expanded legal standing for California's partnership registry is under attack, even though the latest provisions won't take effect until 2005. Two lawsuits have been filed against it, claiming it violates the voter-passed state constitutional amendment that restricts marriage to one man and one woman. One was filed by the religious right group Campaign for California Families, while the other was filed by the chief instigator of the marriage amendment, Republican state senator from Palmdale, Pete Knight. Knight has also co-authored a proposed ballot initiative to repeal the new partnership law. This week, his repeal initiative won clearance to start gathering the nearly 374,000 signatures required for it to go before voters in March.
South Korean actor Hong Suk-chong is appearing on television there this month for the first time since publicly declaring 3 years ago that he is gay. Before South Korea's most publicized coming out to date, Hong was a regular on a leading children's show, a late-night variety show, and a hit sitcom in which he played a swishy fashion designer. Once out, he was dropped from all those shows, and all the offers he'd received since were withdrawn before taping. He was also deluged with hate mail, and his own mother suggested they take poison together. But tolerance has been growing in the interim, thanks in part to the dialogue Hong stimulated and the popularity of entertainer Ha Ri-soo, a trans woman who was one of the first South Koreans to win legal recognition of her self-identified gender. Now Hong is being seen once again playing a designer, this time an openly gay one, a main role in a star-studded miniseries running through December called Perfect Love.
National Coming Out Day is observed in the U.S. on October 11th, but two notables jumped the gun to publicly identify themselves as gay men this week. Kentucky State Senator Ernesto Scorsone is believed to be that conservative state's first elected official to come out. He told reporters it was an independent personal decision, that coming out just seemed like the right thing to do for me, and that this week's Governor's Equal Employment Opportunity Conference just seemed the right time to do it. Having been asked to discuss Governor Paul Patton's May executive order prohibiting sexual orientation discrimination in state employment, he told the crowd of Kentucky civil servants, "As a public official, I was proud that our government was taking this step towards fairness. As a gay Kentuckian, I was proud of the executive order because, while I personally may have been fortunate when it comes to job discrimination, other Kentuckians have not." The Lexington Democrat served 11 years in the Kentucky House and is now in his eighth year in the state Senate. He's running for re-election next year, although he may also campaign for a congressional seat in the future. He's believed to be the 250th openly gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender person among the 511,000 elected officials in the U.S.
And finally, Boston Herald sports columnist Ed Gray played on baseball lingo as he wrote, "I'm out, I wasn't thrown out, and above all, I wasn't forced out. Frankly, I'm out because I can't come up with a single logical reason why I should have denied myself the right to live and work as openly and freely as everyone else." He continued, "I'm out because I no longer in good conscience choose to ignore the unabashed homophobia that is so cavalierly tolerated within the world of sports. I'm out because the silence of a closeted gay man only serves to give his implicit approval to bigotry. I'm out because I refuse to continue hiding from the truth that an openly gay man has as much right as a straight man to play sports or report on them." He noted that no active player in a major professional team sport has ever come out. He believes it likely that there are gay pros who are tolerated because they are closeted, and remarked that somehow a gay teammate is only regarded as a threat if he is honest and a stand-up guy, qualities that are usually valued in team sports. Rejecting common locker room excuses for intolerance, Gray called on professional athletes to demonstrate team solidarity and send the message, We support our teammate, and you should too. He recounted some of this year's widely reported anti-gay quotes from sports figures. From football, San Francisco 49er Garrison Hurst saying, "I don't want any faggots on my team," and New York Giant Jeremy Shockey calling an opposing coach a homo. And from baseball, then Colorado Rocky Todd Jones' response when asked how he'd feel about a gay teammate. "He's got rights or whatever, but he shouldn't walk around proud." Gray closed his column declaring, "I'm out, and I'm exercising my right to walk around proud."
That's News Wrap for the week ending October 4th, 2003. Follow the news in your area. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap is written by Cindy Friedman and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles. For This Way Out, I'm John Beaupre.
And I'm Cindy Friedman.
A gay social anthropologist suggests that history and politics may have more to do with Islamic hostility towards homosexuality than religion. There's a lot to learn later in the program.
Well, folks, we'll be back in a minute with more excitement right after this word.
The first keg was tapped on September 20th and the last sold on October 5th. With its roots in the early 19th century, the Munich Oktoberfest is now a huge international festival that attracts around 6 million visitors from all over the world. In fact, Oktoberfests are now everywhere, with more than 130 this year in North America alone, albeit sometimes with Thai food and no beer at all. It's the strong regional flavor, the Bavarian beer, and the Lederhosen that make the Munich model so popular. But for the last several years, distinctly different Lederhosen have become an important part of the Munich Oktoberfest. Agnes Kruger reports.
Bavaria is big on tradition, and Bavarians wear Lederhosen without any irony. In fact, many visitors would not look out of place in the folklore parade that ushers in the Oktoberfest every year. About 8,000 people in historic costume march 6 kilometers from downtown Munich to the beer tents at the Wiesn Fairground. With its origins in the wedding of Crown Prince Ludwig and Therese von Sachsen-Hildburghausen in 1810, the beer festival is a celebration of mainstream hetero tradition. It also acts as backdrop for one of the biggest days in the gay calendar. The Oktoberfest Gay Day is the highlight of a comprehensive program put on by the Munich Lions Club. Most people are not too sure what the Munich Lions are about.
You know, they're one of the Munich football clubs. Their nickname is the Lions. And so when they heard Munich Lions Club, they thought this is a football fan club instead of the leather fetishist gay club.
Originally a leather club, the Munich Lions now embrace all sorts of fetish variations and combinations. Army, skin, rubber, workman's clothes, and at this time of year, also Lederhosen. Herbert Saskowski is a board member.
Man ist halt einfach vom Club her, haben sich halt einige Leute gesagt, ach, gehen wir mal nachmittags auf die Wiesen.
Basically, a bunch of fetish guys got together to get in some beer and some of the Gemütlichkeit, the cozy atmosphere that the Oktoberfest is so famous for. They then got so much Gemütlichkeit going that what had started out as an informal gathering grew so big that now it fills the entire Bräurosel tent, which seats 6,000. There are 14 tents on the Wiesn, and on the gay day, the Bräurosel is remarkably fuller than the other beer tents. Bavaria is Germany's cradle of conservatism and is such hardly the easiest place to be gay. So for a fetish club to fill a whole Oktoberfest tent is quite remarkable. To be precise, the actual fetish section comprised about 500 to 600 men and was confined to the balcony, which was guarded by bouncers in scant leather pants.
I've been on the balcony quite a couple of times. Yeah, it's different on the balcony a little bit. They're looking down, and you can't see the guys in the rear end of the balcony, of course. But the atmosphere down here is different.
Even though the main tent was absolutely packed, the atmosphere was so relaxed that even the bar staff remarked that it was much less aggressive than on the other days.
They play a couple of very traditional Bavarian songs, and they also mix it with music from the charts, because people like it to sing, what we call schunkeln. I think it's impossible to translate it into English. It's just moving a little bit.
Yeah, and it seems to be really successful, like people standing
on the benches and dancing a little bit, because it's a limited space, so you have to be very careful. Sometimes people miss the bench.
Thousands of gay men and the odd woman here and there, drinking the specially brewed beer, singing and chunkling along to the music. No wonder that the atmosphere grew warmer and warmer.
I think it's accepted that you take off your shirts, but nothing more. So you have to wear your pants and not expose anymore.
At least down here, you mean?
Yeah, at least here, yes. Because we're still in the public, we still have to obey some official rules, have some fun within the rules.
And looking around the masses of men, good-looking men, muscular men, normal men talking, laughing, drinking, hugging, kissing, men just having a good time and being at ease. It's not hard to see what makes the gay day so popular. It is the Gemütlichkeit that embraces Lederhosen and fetish gear side by side and attracts visitors from all over the world.
I was here 3 years ago for Oktoberfest with some friends of mine. It was Gay Day Oktoberfest, but in a much smaller tent than this tent. And we had such a wonderful time that in all the places we've ever traveled, and we travel a lot together, my friends and I, we wanted to come back here one more time. And so we're here again, and it's crazy.
Is there anything like that in the States that you've been to, or anywhere else in the world for that matter?
No, nothing even close. And I do some of the gay circuit stuff in the United States, and the closest thing I would relate this to is like our gay rodeos, which isn't even close to this, but it's the closest thing we have. And everybody's friendly and jovial and has a good time, but nothing like this. That's why I wanted to come back. They're playing with my penny. Don't record that part. So anyway.
He's a big boy.
Why, thank you. It's interesting because although this whole section's gay, there's a lot of a mixed crowd in here, but everybody's having a good time and it's nice.
Even the mayor stopped by the Bräurose. As it happened, it was on the Oktoberfest gay day that the Bavarians re-elected the conservative CSU in their regional parliament. The resigned slogan of the opposition party was "Prevent the two-third majority." This failed, and Bavaria is still in arch-conservative hands. But for 14 years now, the Oktoberfest gay day has been growing bigger and stronger. As Friedi Weiler, a farmer from the outskirts of Munich, says, that one day, once a year, he just had to be there.
Aber da muss man hingehen, sollte man dabei sein.
I'm Agnes Kruger in Munich for This Way Out.
Hi, my name is Billy Bean, and I was a Major League Baseball player from 1986 to 1995. I started with the Detroit Tigers. I played for the Los Angeles Dodgers and the San Diego Padres. I am gay, and you're listening to a show that hits it out of the park every week. This Way Out Radio Magazine.
Muhammad and male homosexuality and vision and passion, the symbolism of male love in Islamic mystical literature, are just two of the articles in the anthology Islamic Homosexualities, Culture, History, and Literature, edited by Stephen O. Murray and Will Roscoe. Both of those articles were written by Dr. James Wafer, an openly gay lecturer in social anthropology at Australia's University of Newcastle. A former Muslim convert, Wafer talks with This Way Out correspondent Michael Schembri about Islam and its historically complex relationship to homosexuality, a history which is not uniformly hostile.
Jim, maybe it's best if we could start with an idea of you telling us briefly, if possible, what is Islam?
I think we need to consider that question in context. At the present time, the context is one where the Berlin Wall has fallen, the Soviet Union has broken apart, and communism is the spent force. So the world of capitalism has thought for some while that it now has global domination. But we realize suddenly in the last few years that there is a force that has filled that vacuum of opposition to global capital, and that opposition has taken the form of Islam. And this is not a question of the age-old enmity between Christianity and Islam, which has been considerably exaggerated. This is Islam and global capital. Islam is technically, according to its theological principles, it is basically anti-capitalist. Islamic law forbids usury, that is, lending money for interest. And although I'm sure there are a large number of wealthy oil sheikhs who make their money through the capitalist system.
At the most basic level, what would a person on the street, a Muslim person on the street, fundamentally believe? What would constitute the basic belief of Islam?
Well, the first principle is there is no God but God, and that Muhammad is his prophet. That is the basic belief. That's the only thing that you really have to believe to become a Muslim. To convert to Islam, you have to believe that there is no God but God, and Muhammad is his prophet. Muslims don't distinguish between that God, whom they call Allah, and the God of Christians and Jews, whom they call the people of the book. The way they differ is in the way they see the prophets. Christianity saw Jesus as the incarnational manifestation of God, whereas for Islam, Jesus is an important prophet, one very beloved by the prophet Muhammad himself, but as only a prophet, not as an incarnation of God. And as for Judaism, Islam believes that it is a continuation of the tradition of the prophets of Judaism, like Ezekiel, Jeremiah, and so on.
At the base of Islam, there are three elements which form the core of where the teachings are derived. That's the Quran.
That's right.
The Sharia and the Hadith.
That's
what
right.
What are they?
The Quran is the holy book that was spoken through the prophet. I mean, the archangel Gabriel is said to have come to the prophet and simply said to him, write, and the prophet was illiterate. It is supposed that the prophet went into a kind of trance state and others transcribed what he spoke while he was in this trance state. And these are the words that have become the Holy Quran. The people who were living at the time were quite capable of distinguishing what the prophet said when he was in this state from what he said when he was living his day-to-day life. And the sayings of his day-to-day life have become known as a hadith, or the collection of hadith, which is a single saying of the prophet. The things that the prophet said in his day-to-day life were taken as important guides for other people's daily lives as well.
And the Sharia?
It's the traditional law of Islam, which is based on the Quran and the Hadith, and also to some extent on the Akhbar, which are the stories about the Prophet's life, but they don't have the same weight as the Hadith, which are direct quotations from the Prophet.
The average person in the West has a certain understanding of Islam regarding homosexuality. It's basically a perception drawn from practice in certain countries, say Saudi Arabia or Afghanistan or Pakistan or, say, Malaysia, where they can be pretty brutal towards people who are accused of being homosexual.
Yes.
Is this tough line against homosexuality necessarily true to Islam?
Well, it depends on interpretation. I mean, for centuries, Europeans regarded the Islamic world as the place that you went to if you wanted to have gay sex. It was punishable by death in large parts of Europe. This has been a tradition that goes back at least to Sir Richard Burton, who translated the Arabian Nights, and in more recent times, people like Joe Orton and ceremonial magician Aleister Crowley and André Gide, the French writer, have all gone to Muslim countries because they found it easier to have gay sex there than in the West. So there's a difference between the official line, which is that, and even the official line depends on the interpretation put on the Quran and the Hadith by the various Islamic schools of jurisprudence. And these schools themselves differ over the extent to which homosexual relations are bad. Most of them think that, okay, they're not the ideal thing for a good Muslim to do, but some of them go to the extreme of saying that people caught in a homosexual act should be stoned to death or thrown from the highest building in town and so on. But there is a wide variety in these interpretations. And at the present time, the kind of interpretation that's become dominant is the one that comes from the school of jurisprudence that's dominant in Saudi Arabia, which is very fundamentalist and thinks that homosexuality should be punished severely.
I believe there's also a historic explanation for the traditional Islamic opposition or dislike of homosexuality.
It may have something to do with the world in which the Prophet himself lived. I mean, in that kind of context, making another male sexually passive was a form of humiliation. To some extent, this is possibly still the case. The way that boys grow up in Muslim countries is usually that they have gay sex as the passive partner when they're younger, and then learn to be the active partner as they get older, and then unless they are really gay, then they will perceive that as not incompatible with their role as men, as fulfilling the role of the good Muslim husband and father. The thing is in Islam that every male is supposed to be married. This is the major reason why Muslims in countries of the Muslim diaspora, like, say, Australia or Canada or the UK or the USA, have such difficulties, because they see a way of life where gays and lesbians reject marriage and look for a life with each other. And they often have a very difficult time with their families, because in Islam, it's not so important what you do outside the marriage, but you know, the marriage itself is the essential thing.
That doesn't sound too different to various Christian traditions.
I think that's true, although in the 30 years since gay liberation, there's been an enormous change in the West with regard to all of that. And in Islam, it's also important that this all be kept under wraps. You know, it's important not to talk about it. I mean, what gay liberation has done is it's made homosexuality an issue that you can not only speak about, but that you can speak about in fairly sort of subtle and differentiated ways. Whereas in Islam, the silence surrounding homosexuality is pretty complete. It's something that would be talked about in whispers, perhaps, but, you know, it's not something that could be discussed publicly in the way that we talk about these issues in the West.
Dr. James Wafer is a contributor to the anthology Islamic Homosexualities, Culture, History, and Literature, published by New York University Press. The social anthropologist considers the future of Islam and efforts to reinterpret its traditions. Next time on This Way Out. Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the international lesbian and gay radio magazine. This week, Cindy Friedman, John Beaupre, Fensberry, Graham Underhill, Rex Walkner, Agnes Kruger, and Michael Schembri contributed program material. Omar Farouk Takbilik performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. Remember, you can also listen to This Way Out anytime online, exclusively on Planet Out. There's a link at our website, thiswayout.org. Some This Way Out operating expenses are funded through direct charitable donations from our listeners. Thank you. To find out how you can help keep This Way Out on the air, or for audio cassette subscription information, please visit our website at thiswayout.org, email us at tworadio@aol.com, or write to us at Post Office Box 38327, Los Angeles, California 90038, USA. And thanks to AlternaBid and the Stonewall Society, you can still bid on some terrific items in an online auction to benefit This Way Out. Look for the This Way Out auction area at alternabid.com. For associate producer Lucia Chappell and all of us at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks very much for listening on WRSU New Brunswick, New Jersey, KBOO Portland, Oregon, CFUV Victoria, British Columbia, and more than 150 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. And we hope you'll stay tuned.